Dr. Mark Newman is a demanding communication trainer, incisive pro-life apologist, president of Speaker for Life, and author of Contenders, a church-wide strategy to unmask abortion, defeat its advocates, empower Christians, and change the world. He's spoken at virtually every major pro-life conference in the country. Mark is the former director of speech and debate at the University of California at Irvine and is retired from teaching at the doctoral program at the School of Communications and the Arts at Regent University. He is the co-founder of Defending Life Summer Institute at Cedarville University in Ohio. He has trained speakers in the public and private sectors for over 30 years. Mark is also a cultural analyst and has appeared on Fox News and in Time Magazine. He is from North San Diego County. Still? Okay, you moved to Tennessee. Okay, I was about to say the rest of the story. But relocated to beautiful eastern Tennessee with his wife, Sharon, and their youngest son, Joel. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm Liberty Church welcome to Dr. Mark Newman.
Am I live? I'm live. Okay, yay. Do you have a question already? Oh, no, she needs a handout. Okay. We do a little housekeeping here before we get started. This is the first and most important part. These are outlines, and you're going to need pens. Did you hear the part about where I'm a college professor? Now, we take what we say very seriously, and we expect you to as well. So please have a pen and get ready to write, because we're going to be doing quite a bit of that this evening. I was telling everybody I was really glad when I came to church this morning to find that, by the way, how many of you go to church here? Raise your hand. Oh, wrong question. How many of you don't go to church here and just came anyway? Hands up. Okay. For those of you who do go to church here, you know that Pastor Paul speaks very rapidly, so you're going to feel right at home. We're going to take a break just about at the half. So that'll be awesome. Matter of fact, I don't know if you can do anything about that clock up there, but if you could set that clock to like an hour and 25 minutes, so I'll get a countdown going, that'd be great. And then if you have questions while I am speaking, would you please write them down on your notes? Because that way, when it comes to be Q&A time, and I say, hey, anybody have any questions? You can read the question you have, and it'll be much more carefully thought out if you write it down first. And then when I answer it, you can take notes, and therefore you will have actually the answer to your question as part of your note package. That'd be great. Finally, over there on the table, you may not go over and look at them until the break. And then if you do buy one of those books during the break, if I catch you reading it while I am talking during the second part, you know bad things will happen to you. Demerits. I don't know what you can do here in this church, but we'll work something out. Can we pray really quick, and then we'll get started? Father in heaven, I'd like to thank you so much for an opportunity to be together with these fine people tonight and learn how to stand in the gap to save the lives of unborn children created in your image. Father, I pray that everything that is said tonight that is true sticks, and everything that doesn't blows away like the chaff in the wind. We ask these things in your son's name. Amen. Always pray that, because you know what? You never really know. I just want God's truth to be the thing that prevails here. When I tell people that I'm pro-life, a lot of people say, by the way, do I need this? I don't think I need it. Oh, good. I want to get that out of the way. I feel like I'm looking, you know, through this at you. When I tell people I'm pro-life, a lot of people go, well, of course you're pro-life. After all, you're a Christian. All Christians are. In fact, the only reason that you're pro-life is because you're a Christian. You know, if you thought about that for about 2 seconds, you'd realize what a completely ludicrous comment that would possibly be. It's the same thing as people saying the only reason you're a Christian is because your parents are Christians, because if that were true, there would be no converts. Right? It's a kind of a foolish thing to say. I am not, I know this may sound as like a shocker to you, I am not pro-life because I'm a Christian, although I would like to believe that because I'm a Christian, I should be pro-life, but that is not why I am pro-life. The reason I am pro-life is because I spent 20 years as a debate coach. See, I've always taught my students to find out what is true, and then once you know what is true, follow it. That is the quest of the academic life. So the reason that I am pro-life is because I've looked at the evidence. As a debate coach, it's really interesting. When they write debate topics, they always write topics where there's usually a fairly even amount of evidence on both sides of the issue, which is why the national debate topic, to the best of my knowledge, has never chosen abortion as the topic that they're going to debate. because the debates would be over quickly by anybody who was willing to spend any time at all learning to make that case. Now, I got to let you know, we're going to be talking about abortion tonight. We're going to learn how to make the case for life, and the problem is most people can't do it. I'm glad you're here tonight. Look around the room. You guys you're the chosen few here. Most people can't do it. When I say most people, I don't just mean most average, everyday Christians. I mean even a lot of people who are professionally in this ministry work. They can't do it. I know this because when we put on the applied bioethics class over at Oklahoma Wesleyan, we shifted over to Cedarville, Ohio recently. Our first class was made up of 25 pregnancy center directors. They sat with Scott Klusendorf, my buddy, to go through 1 week of pro-life apologetics, and then he turned them over to me. It's not all fun and games in the class, ladies and gentlemen. How many of you guys had a speech class in high school or college? How many speeches did you give in that class? Just kind of pop out some numbers. 3, 1, 4. Okay. My class? 20. And it was only because it was a condensed class where it takes place in 1 week. In my regular 16-week semester class, it's 32. So see, we don't play. But if you were to ask those directors when they stood up for the first time in my class, can you make a case for life? They couldn't do it. At the end of the week, they could. There's lots of things I'm really, really bad at. Don't get me anywhere near power tools, you know, for example. But I'm a really good speech coach, and I can turn you into a pretty cranking public speaker in a week if you'll let me. But most people, even professionals, can't do it. And as a result, human beings are dying. Since Roe versus Wade in 1973, over 65 million children have lost their lives in the United States because of abortion. I would love to tell you that since the Dobbs decision, that number has dropped dramatically. It has dropped. But there are still approximately 850,000 to 900,000 abortions which are occurring across the United States annually. The Dobbs decision was like the Missouri Compromise, folks. It was not the Emancipation Proclamation. What it really did is it rolled back the clock to 1973. And now we live in a United States, actually a dis-United States, where we literally have life states and death states. Fortunately, to a large extent, here in Oklahoma, you live in a life state. I moved from California, which is absolutely a death state. You'll find out just how badly during the course of this evening. And I've moved to Tennessee, which is a life state. So we have life states and we have death states. And California has literally used the Dobbs decision to completely and utterly double down on their commitment to abortion, both as an ideology and also as an action. I'm holding in my hands the Future of Abortion Council. This is a California document. They have the Future of Abortion Council. This was put together by Governor Gavin Newsom. By the way, Gavin Newsom has also put together a group of 21 death state governors. They've all joined together to create this kind of coalition for reproductive justice. That's the euphemism that they use. In this document, these folks, these pro-abortion folks, they put together 45 different recommendations. To date, I believe over 25 of them have been turned into law. But they weren't satisfied, nope. So in December 2022, they put out an even thicker addendum. And I am telling you, because of the way California is governed, it will be only a matter of time before most, if not all, of these recommendations find their way into law. They're exporting abortion to other states. Some of you may have known that Governor Newsom actually took money out of his reelection campaign and used it to fund pro-abortion billboards in 7 pro-life states. In other words, they're planning to actually infiltrate pro-life states. It's an amazing billboard, right? It said something along the lines of, you need an abortion, California's here to help. And at the bottom, they actually put a scripture verse. Okay? Folks, that's not just misguided. That's demonic. But that's what we're kind of facing here in this battle. What's really odd is that post-Dobbs, an interesting thing happened. Rather than a sense of victory beginning to spread throughout the churches, what I really found was a sense of what I guess I would just call a sense of despair. See, even here in pro-life states, what ended up happening is a lot of people thought, woohoo, we won. And then I'm working with people who are pregnancy center directors, like Linda over here, and clinic directors. And what I'm hearing from them is that a lot of their support sometimes is drying up. Why? Because people think we're done and we don't need pregnancy centers anymore. Now, I flip the script and I talk to directors like Aaron Rodgers over in Bakersfield. And she tells me her people are drying up too. You want to know why? They get the sense they can't possibly win. And so they think, well, we should take our donation dollars and put them somewhere else where we've got a better chance of winning. So isn't it interesting that at the moment of what has been over the last few decades our greatest victory, we've literally stepped back from the battle. Okay, my understanding is your pastor used to be a football player. Is that right? Football player? Yeah. Gridiron to the gospel right now. Yeah, okay. See, I pay attention. The one thing you don't want to do, folks, when you're playing a competitive game is spike the football early. Okay? So we've got an opportunity here, and we need to absolutely seize it. The battle is not remotely over. Literally, the Dobbs decision, all it did is it gave us permission to start. And in states like California, please remember that neither Roe nor Dobbs requires anyone to have an abortion. Nothing about the law requires someone to have an abortion. What that means is that we all have an opportunity to step into the lives of women considering abortion, meet them where they're at, provide them with the spiritual, emotional, and medical resources that they need in order to make life-affirming decisions for their children. So tonight what we're going to do is we're going to become better at how to persuade people to abandon abortion ideology and embrace a life-affirming culture. We can literally have victories right here, right now, if we will pursue them. Now, I need to let you know that in a room this size, it is a veritable statistical certainty that there are people in this room who participated in abortion. And some of the things I'm going to say tonight, some of the things we're going to talk about, could be very difficult for you to listen to. They're in fact going to fly in the face of almost everything that popular culture tells you about abortion. I am not here tonight to heap guilt on anybody. I am here tonight, if this is part of your past, and by the way, a lot of times people think, oh, ladies, no, also men. Okay? I've had young men come into my office as a college professor sobbing because their girlfriend got an abortion and they couldn't do anything about it. I've had women come into my office and tell me about the boy who coerced her into having an abortion. So I don't know where on the spectrum we fall, but I'm telling you statistically there are people in here who've been involved to one degree or another in abortion. And so not here to heap guilt on you. I'm here to do two things tonight. I want us to understand the truth so that we can help people to avoid making those kinds of mistakes. And if for some reason you have already made that mistake or you know people who have, I want to make it abundantly clear that there is not a single sin anyone in this room has ever committed that is beyond the healing power of the blood of Jesus Christ. Amen? Okay. So I'm in a Baptist church. This is great. Amen. So I want you to make that really, really clear as the evening rolls out, right, that if at any point in time the enemy is coming alongside you, trying to make you feel terrible about decisions in your past, you lay that at the foot of the cross and there is healing and forgiveness and restoration there. Tonight what we're going to do is we're going to learn how to make the case for life by looking at the scientific, the moral, and the biblical evidence. Then we're going to talk about the risk all of us face from the philosophical assumptions of abortion advocates. And then finally, we're going to discuss what each one of us can do. But before we get started, a couple of things. First of all, can we all agree that in 3 hours, I couldn't even read this one book to you? I'll agree with this. Okay, this is David Boonen's book, A Defense of Abortion. It's probably the cutting-edge, best book out there, making the argument that abortion is morally permissible. I could not read this to you in 3 hours. I am not going to be able to cover every single solitary argument that exists on abortion in the time we have today. The good news is, I don't have to. See, I've been going on to college campuses, and every time I go, I keep waiting for somebody to come up with some, you know, marginal, weird, odd, abortion argument that I've rarely heard, and I never, ever do. I literally keep hearing these same old, tired, defeated arguments that I hear over and over and over again, and we're going to go through all of those today. You are going to learn about all of the most common pro-abortion arguments that are out there and how to respond to them. Now, if for some reason you happen to run into David Boonen at a Starbucks, which I hope that you don't, not only because I don't want you to run into David Boonin, but because I don't want you drinking coffee at Starbucks. Should you run into David Boonin or some other philosopher at Starbucks, I'm going to teach you all a very intriguing and humbling and exit strategy-oriented phrase that any of you can employ at any time, and it will help you in a lot of ways. Number one, it'll build humility, which is a good thing. So you ready? We're all going to learn this phrase together. Ready? Here we go. Somebody asks you something, and you're clueless. So you say, I don't know. But I'll find out. Okay. Because if you don't know, there are plenty of people who do know. As a matter of fact, this big, thick book by David Boonin, it was responded to in this much thinner book by a guy named Christopher Kaiser. It's called The Ethics of Abortion. In this book, he point by point demolishes, in my estimation, David's book. Now, how good is this book? Let me read you a blurb on the back. This is one of the very best book-length defenses of the claim that abortion is morally impermissible. Shouldn't do it. It is clear, thorough, thoughtful, and carefully argued. I would strongly encourage anyone who's interested in the subject to read it and to study it. Pretty good blurb, huh? You know who wrote it? David Boonin. These guys are actually intellectual friends. We're kind of hoping eventually Chris flips David. We'll see what happens. So I'm not going to be able to get through with everything, but we're going to get through all of the most common stuff. Now, one other thing. During the course of this evening, by the time we're all done, you are not going to know this stuff. You will have been exposed to this stuff. Any of you guys ever just skim over a book or maybe just listen to the professor's lectures and then show up on the day of the exam? How'd your exam go? Let me help you. Not well. Okay? So what do you have to do to be able to utilize knowledge easily and effectively? You have to study. So this is an introduction to this material, but if you want to be able to use it well, you're going to have to spend some time. You're going to have to read, and you're going to have to study. All right, where do we begin? The first thing we have to do, I never used to have to do this, but I have to do it now. We have to begin by defining our terms. Have any debaters in here, high school or college debaters? None? Oh, goodness. Okay. Oh, one? Good for you. So you know that when you start a debate case, the first thing you do is you define terms. It used to be you talk about abortion and everybody agreed, but how many of you guys saw after the Dobbs decision came out those really interesting memes that started popping up on Facebook? Did you see them? Right? Told you things like, in a post-Roe world, women are going to run around and they will be carrying stillborn children in their uterus because no one will get rid of them and women will die from ectopic pregnancy. Right? You heard all this stuff. Let me tell you why. They decided to use the broadest sense of the term abortion. Any military people in the room? Hands up. Oh, quite a few. Okay, so your CO sends you out on a mission. Part of the way out, he calls you all back. You don't complete the mission. We say that mission was aborted. All the word abortion means is it is a premature ending of a particular series of events. That's all abortion. The word as general as possible. That's what it means. So what our opponents have done is they've said, see, these guys are anti-abortion. And that would include things like treating women for ectopic pregnancies or dealing with women who have completely unviable pregnancies that are going to put a woman's life at risk. So we have things like when a woman miscarries, there's a word for that. It's called a spontaneous abortion. And they try to conflate all that together. So every time I use the word abortion tonight, unless I specify otherwise, we're going to be talking about elective abortion. An elective abortion, let me define it for you, is an act of violence that intentionally kills an innocent human being. An elective abortion is an act of violence that intentionally kills an innocent human being. You might notice I did not say it's a medical procedure. See, in order for it to be a medical procedure, pregnancy would have to be a disease and children would have to be tumors. And by the way, the way our opponents talk about it, you almost think they believe that. Yeah. So when we talk about elective abortion, it's an act of violence that intentionally kills an innocent human being. So when we're going to make the argument, some of you have been told, oh, you know, the case for life, the whole abortion issue, it's just so unbelievably complex. Who could possibly master it? I mean, after all, look at this big, thick book by, oh, gosh, who could ever know all of this stuff? The abortion issue on the street level is unbelievably simple. And anybody can master it. As a matter of fact, you're going to master it tonight. It's going to be really simple. Wait a minute, you told me that I have to study. Well, yeah, but just to understand the case, very, very simple. How many of you remember syllogisms from your high school or college philosophy class, right? Syllogism is a kind of an argument which, if the premises are true and the argument is validly constructed, the conclusion is inescapable. So, I'll remind you. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. Congratulations. That's a syllogism. Here's the syllogism for the pro-life case. It is wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. By the way, if somebody's not willing to stipulate that, move away slowly. Okay? It is wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being, right? Almost everybody will agree with that. It's the second premise that people have problems with. So it's wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. I'm going to argue that abortion intentionally kills an innocent human being. And if that's the case, right, if it's true that it's wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being, and if it's true that abortion intentionally kills an innocent human being, therefore abortion would be... Does that sound terribly complex to you? Pretty simple. Now, where you're going to get some pushback, right, is in that middle premise, that second premise. People are going to say, oh, you know, I'm not really sure that what's in the womb is really a human being, and even if it was, I don't know that abortion's out there intentionally killing it. So my burden as somebody making an argument for life is to prove that what's in a woman's body from the moment of conception is a distinct, whole, separate, living human being. And that abortion intentionally kills that human being. Now, if I can prove that, then I've proven that abortion intentionally kills an innocent human being, and therefore, since we've all agreed that it's wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being, abortion would be wrong. So let's see if we can make that case. We're going to start with the scientific case for life, because the first thing we have to determine is what's in a woman's body. So when you want to find out about medical stuff, you want to look to science. So let's see. Let me tell you what abortion clinics and many people say. At the clinic and at the popular level, some abortion choice advocates continue to assert, and many people currently believe, that a fetus is not a human being. As a matter of fact, they've got other terms for that being. That's just a blob of tissue. It's an undifferentiated cell mass. It's the products of conception. It's the uterine contents. And one of my favorites is the one that's coming out these days from Planned Parenthood. Let me read to you. This is from Planned Parenthood's own website in discussing aspiration abortions. They never even refer to the unborn at all. Listen to what they say. The doctor or nurse will use a small handheld suction device or suction machine to gently take the pregnancy tissue out of your uterus. They may also use a small surgical tool called a curette to remove any tissue that's left in your uterus or check to make sure that your uterus is totally empty. So notice what's missing here? No sense of what is being aborted. So let's take a look. You know, when I want to find out what's going on inside of a woman's body, I want to, you know, look at people who actually study that very thing. And the kind of doctors that study, or scientists that study that very thing, are called embryologists. So, Moore, Persaud, and Torche, in the latest edition of their long-standing textbook, The Developing Human, Clinically Oriented Embryology. And by the way, if you're trying really hard to write down really, really fast, I'm going to send you, if you're registered, my assistant's going to send you in the next day or two a packet of information. A lot of it will have these source citations on it. I say long-standing because this book is in multiple editions, and in every edition, this particular sentence goes virtually unchanged. Every time they put out a new edition, I search it to make sure. Did they keep it? And they did. Human development begins at fertilization when a sperm fuses with an oocyte to form a single cell, the zygote. This highly specialized, totipotent cell, capable of giving rise to any cell type, marks the beginning of each of us as a unique individual. Okay, just to clarify, that's not like my perspective. This is a medical fact. Some people will say foolish things like, well, you know, Mark, when you're talking about life, Life is a long continuum process that goes out over eons. And so to talk about any particular individual human life, it's really to kind of obscure the overall flow of life through the age. No. Sorry. I'm going to guess you actually value your own particular human life. And your own particular human life had a very neat beginning. It began when your mother's egg united with your father's sperm, and that created you immediately. What do they say? Oh, look, it marks the beginning of each of us as a unique individual. Geneticists know. Dr. Jerome Lejeune, professor of fundamental genetics at the University of René Descartes, who discovered, by the way, the genetic basis for Down syndrome, that guy. He was testifying before the subcommittee on the separation of powers of the U.S. Senate Committee on the Judiciary back in 1981. So now we've gone from 2020 down to 1981. What does he say? At 2 months of age, the human being is less than one thumb's length from the head to the rump. He would fit with ease into a nutshell. But everything is there. Hands, feet, head, organs, brain, all are in place. His heart has been beating for a month already. Looking closely, you would see the palm creases. With a good magnifier, the fingerprints could be detected. Every document is available for a national identity card. The human nature of the being from conception to old age is not a metaphysical contention. In other words, we're not talking about anything religious here. He says it is plain evidence. Let's go back a little farther. 1970. California Medicine. This is the official journal of the California Medical Association. Way back there in 1970, they talked about the curious avoidance of the scientific fact, which everyone really knows, that human life begins at conception and is continuous, whether intra or extra uterine, until death. I'm sorry, did they say only geneticists and embryologists know this? No, what'd they say? Who knows this? Everyone really knows. Oh, now we'll go all the way back to 1951. This is a brochure called The Gift of Life. By the way, if you look really closely, it looks like people going to or coming from church. Right? It is a sex education manual that was apparently used in churches in 1951. And in it, they talk about where babies come from. It says, if one of the male sperm meets and unites with an egg cell, a new life begins. Doesn't that sound exactly like what Moore, Persaud, and Tortia said? 70 years later? This isn't a one-off. This isn't something new. Everybody's known this forever. By the way, when I say everybody, I mean everybody, because this little brochure, it was distributed by the Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Everybody knows human life begins at conception. Remember my burdens? My burdens are I must prove that what's in a woman's body from the moment of conception is a real, live, whole, separate, distinct, living human being, right? Have I done that? Yes. By the way, did I do it citing material from the National Right to Life? No. No. Who did I cite? I cite embryologists. I cite geneticists. I cite California Medicine's, the official journal of the California Medical Association, Planned Parenthood. They all tell me the same thing. What's in a woman's body from the moment of conception is a real, live, whole, distinct, separate human being, living human being. That was the first of my burdens. What about my second burden? Does abortion kill a human being? Abortion clinics try to hide that fact. They use intriguing terms. They call what's in a woman's body, well, it's an embryo or it's a fetus, as if this is something other than a human being. They talk about things like, we're going to terminate the pregnancy. We're going to evacuate the uterine contents. We're going to gently remove pregnancy tissue. But experts disagree. Folks, the term embryo and fetus, they're just arbitrary labels that people put on something. And by the way, anybody here, this is how you can tell who your homeschooling parents are. Any of your kids learning Latin now? You guys laugh. I'm telling you, there are guys out there doing this. Anybody know Latin? Any Latin at all? Oh, I've got a couple of people out here. The word fetus means, anybody know? What's it? Bit more babies. What else? Little one. It means little one. Offspring is another word, is another way you can translate fetus. So all a fetus is your offspring. These are just arbitrary labels. So every one of you began your life as a zygote. That's the label we put on that single cell every single one of you began as. And the minute you began as that, if somebody had a sufficiently powerful microscope and they could look at your DNA, they would know immediately that you were a separate human being. Because the DNA in that cell was not the DNA in the body that was carrying you. Different DNA. Get a little bit bigger, they call you an embryo. Get a little bit bigger, they call you a fetus. Get a little bit bigger and pop out, suddenly you are a newborn. Then you become a toddler. Then you become a little boy or a little girl. Then you become an adolescent. Then later, I guess they got a new word, a tweener, right before you quite make it to teenagerhood. Then you get to be a teenager, right? Then you get to be a young adult, a middle-aged adult, a seasoned wise adult, right? Amen. So that's what happens. All these labels, they're just arbitrary labels that people put on different stages of an individual human being's development from the beginning till the end. By the way, there's no such thing as pregnancy tissue. Anybody in this room ever suffer from anxiety? Hands up. I have. Anybody? Yeah. Did they offer to surgically remove your anxiety tissue? No? Do you want to know why they didn't? Because anxiety is a condition. It's not a thing. Pregnancy is a condition. It's not a thing. You are pregnant with something, right? Cats are pregnant with little cats. Dogs get pregnant with little dogs. And human beings get pregnant with little humans, right? It's a condition. It is not a thing. I've got this great brochure here. It's called Plan Your Children for Health and Happiness. See this? And this is way, way back. This is like in 1960s or earlier. They're talking in this brochure about birth control. And so they ask the question, birth control, is it an abortion? Listen to how they respond. Definitely not. An abortion kills the life of a baby after it has begun. There it is. It is dangerous to your life and health. It may make you sterile so that when you want a child, you cannot have it. There it is. Right? Intriguing part about all this is this was also published by Planned Parenthood. This is what Planned Parenthood told everybody in the 1960s and earlier. Now, I know some of you guys are looking at this going, oh, I don't know, Dr. Newman, this thing's looking a little photoshopped. Which is why I'm so glad I own an original one. See, in a debate environment, having an original becomes very, very handy. Now, the only difference between this one and this one, well, two of them, one is they have different covers, which shows me that this brochure went through multiple iterations. Also, this one varies in language just a little bit from this one. In this one, they insert the sentence, an abortion requires an operation. But it does still say in here, an abortion kills the life of a baby after it's begun. Isn't it interesting that in the late 70s and beyond, it became impossible, if you were to debate the abortion issue, if you were pro-life, you couldn't say baby. That's not a baby. It's really funny because Planned Parenthood used to call them that. Okay? Everybody knows it's a baby. Doctors know it's a baby, and the doctors know that abortion kills that baby. Remember that little excerpt I read to you from California Medicine? What I didn't tell you was it was a pro-abortion article. In 1970, see, Ronald Reagan signed the Therapeutic Abortion Act. Ronald Reagan actually introduced abortion into the state of California. These guys, they wrote this essay. I'm going to read it to you, and I'm going to send you a link to a page where you will be able to download this and read it for yourself. Listen to what they wrote. 1970, 3 years before Roe versus Wade. Remember Roe versus Wade where they said that there wasn't a consensus on when human life began? Yeah. Listen to this. Since the old ethic has not yet been fully displaced, it has been necessary to separate the idea of abortion from the idea of killing, which continues to be socially abhorrent. The result has been a curious avoidance of the scientific fact, which everyone really knows, that human life begins at conception and is continuous, whether intra or extra uterine, until death. The very considerable semantic gymnastics, that's a fancy word for lies, which are required to rationalize abortion as anything but the taking of a human life, would be ludicrous if they were not often put forth under socially impeccable auspices. What are they saying here? Okay. You guys remember in like the 70s and 80s, women would get pregnant, their abdomens would be really out and extended, and they'd wear these big stretchy t-shirts, and they'd have an arrow pointing down, right? And over the top of it, it would say, products of conception down here. No? No? Uterine contents this way. No, what did it say?
Baby.
Everybody knows it's a baby. These guys say, everybody knows it's a baby, so if you tell them it's not, it's going to be ludicrous unless we lie to people and we do it often under socially impeccable auspices. If we can get the government to say it, if we can get the educational establishment to say it, if we can get entertainment media to say it, doctors to say it, and if we could get some clergy to say it, then we could probably overcome that intuition. Oh, but they're not done. Next sentence. It is suggested by the authors that this schizophrenic sort of subterfuge is necessary because while a new ethic is being accepted, the old one has not yet been rejected. Now, what was that old ethic that in 1970 had not yet been rejected? That old ethic, they identified at the beginning of the essay. It's the Judeo-Christian ethic. And they argue, we've got to get rid of that. The Judeo-Christian ethic is the ethic that believes that every human being has objective moral value. Everybody equally has objective moral value. And they say we have to replace that with an ethic where people have relative moral value. And I found it fascinating who they identified as the kind of people who should be able to make that determination. You might be surprised to find that California medicine thinks it ought to be doctors. Right? They said in order for them to set themselves up at the forefront of death selection and death control, they had to first establish themselves at the forefront of birth selection and birth control. And they did it, and it worked. Do we know when human life begins? Yes, everybody knows. And does abortion kill a child? Well, yeah. And who knows that? Everybody knows. In fact, abortion choice advocates even agree. Camille Paglia, by the way, smart woman, very, very bright woman. I've seen her in podcasts with people like Jordan Peterson. She's very smart. She just happens to be very wrong on this issue. Back in 2008 in Salon Magazine, listen to what she wrote. Hence, I have always frankly admitted that abortion is murder, the extermination of the powerless by the powerful. Liberals, she is one, for the most part, have shrunk from facing the ethical consequences of their embrace of abortion, which results in the annihilation of concrete individuals and not just clumps of insensate tissue. She said the quiet part out loud. By the way, in the very next sentence, she says, nevertheless, the federal government's got no business regulating it. I read that and my head exploded. Maybe I read this wrong. I've looked at it again. But, whoa, what? Regulating what? Murder. What kind of, murder of powerless people by powerful people. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm here to tell you that I think that probably the very first requirement of any just government is to keep powerful people from exterminating powerless people. And yet she says no. And frankly, I think even David Boone, in this big thick book of his, he kind of gives away the farm really early. He does it, though, in the preface of his book. You know that part nobody reads? You know? He talks about his son Eli, and he's got pictures of his son Eli rolling around on the grass, playing at the beach. And then he writes, in the top drawer of my desk, I keep another picture of Eli. This picture was taken on September 7th, 1993, 24 weeks before he was born. The sonogram image is murky, but it reveals clearly enough a small head tilted back slightly and an arm raised up and bent with the hand pointed back toward the face and the thumb extended out toward the mouth. There is no doubt in my mind that this picture, too, shows the same little boy at a very early stage in his physical development, and there is no question that the position I defend in this book entails that it would have been morally permissible to end his life at this point. Did he say it would have been morally permissible to make him disappear? No. Wave a magic wand and suddenly make sure that my wife's pregnancy was terminated and then nothing really happened? No. It would have been morally permissible to do what? Oh, to end his life. So the man who wrote the biggest, thickest book arguing for the moral permissibility of abortion acknowledges at the very beginning that he is purposefully ending the life. It would have been okay for him to purposefully end the life of his own young son. I'm a college professor. I'm a debater. Pastor's a pastor. People like us, right, you work in the realm of ideas. Imagine some politician or politically motivated people out here in the audience, and it's really easy to start thinking about things in the world of ideas. So we have a tendency oftentimes to think about abortion as a political issue or maybe a moral issue. Some of you, you know, it's a spiritual issue, and it is all of these things, but it's not primarily any of those things. Not primarily. See, primarily, abortion is an action. And that action creates casualties. And I would be remiss in my duty to you this evening if I allowed you to walk out of this auditorium tonight believing this was nothing more than an issue. But see, here's the problem. Anybody watch the Discovery Channel? You ever watch that? You can see anything on the Discovery Channel. You can watch a guy having a colonoscopy right on the Discovery Channel. Right, you can watch somebody have a rotator cuff surgery, put themselves all back. You can see all of that on the Discovery Channel. But you want to know the one thing you can't see on the Discovery Channel? You'll never see an abortion on the Discovery Channel. Now, why is that? If it is, after all, as our opponents claim, if it's nothing more than absolutely health care, then why can't you see one? So I'm going to do something I really don't enjoy doing, and just to make it clear, this will be probably the fifth time I've watched this video this week, because I never show it without watching it, ever. So I'm about to put a video up on the screen, and I'm going to tell you right now, what you're going to see in that video is the graphic aftermath of having an abortion. It's going to start at 7 weeks, and it's going to go all the way to 24 weeks. It's very graphic. It takes 1 minute. It doesn't have any verbiage in it. It's just some music in the background. It's just images. I do not want you to look at anything you do not want to see. And for those of you with young children, you may choose to make sure that they don't see it. We can step outside for a minute if you like. But I promise you this, after you see this, you will never think about this as an issue ever again, in the same way that after you saw some of you, I could just simply talk about a naked little girl running away from a burning village, and you will immediately see images of Vietnam in your head, because that image burnt itself into your mind. That's what these images are going to do. And yep, I'm going to do it to you on purpose, because we have neglected this issue for far too long, because we just don't really believe it is what we say it is. But you won't think that now. Go ahead. I can think of a lot of things I would rather do than look at that or talk about this. I don't know if you know this. I'm actually trained to be a cultural analyst. I'm supposed to be watching, you know, Marvel movies and talking about how they create worldviews in the minds of people who see them. I get tired of doing this sometimes, and I've been doing it for 40 years. But until this battle is over, I will watch those videos, and they'll remind me why I'm here. Now, here's the really wild part. You saw the images of children 7 weeks to 10 weeks. Clearly, they have body parts. And you know what we're doing now in this country? We are having people mailing abortion pills to young women in brown paper wrappers. They're going and they're taking these pills in the privacy of their own home, and they're giving birth to dead children that are that developed. There's no counselor. There's no physician. They're sitting there at home by themselves. That's the kind of psychological dissonance that we are creating in the minds of predominantly young people all across this country, to the tune of hundreds of thousands of them a year. This, ladies and gentlemen, is what we are up against. This action that creates these casualties. Once we establish that science informs us that the unborn are human beings and that abortion actually kills them, this establishes all the facts we need to prove that syllogism, right? So some of you are thinking, well, don't we get to go home now? We're done, right? We should be. It is wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. Abortion intentionally kills an innocent human being. Who knows it? Again, did I cite anywhere here? Did I cite National Right to Life? Or any other right to life biased oriented organizations? Once? Have I cited one? Nope. Everybody knows it. Our opponents know it. They just like it. So once we establish, right, it's wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. Now we know abortion intentionally kills an innocent human being. Therefore, abortion is wrong. Our opponents go, well, you know, maybe we need to back away from that first premise a little bit. Maybe it's not always wrong to intentionally kill some human beings. And by the way, this is the road to Auschwitz. Maybe it's okay to kill some human beings. So what will we do? Let's make a determination that there's some human beings who are persons and other human beings who are dehumanized non-persons. And the non-persons, we can put them to death. By the way, this is a tale as old as humanity. This is what we do to each other, ladies and gentlemen. And this is what these folks are going to want to do. Now, if we want to examine this idea of personhood, we have to move away from science, because science can't tell you who a person is. See, a person, it's a moral category. It's not a scientific category. So what we're going to have to do now is we're going to move into session two. We're going to have to look at the ethical case for life. Can we bring the house lights up a little bit more? Because I want everybody to be able to look at each other. House lights, there we go. Okay. Take a look around the room. Look. Are we all exactly the same, identical to one another? No, we are not. Okay, no, there are differences. So even though we are not all exactly the same, intriguingly, people will say that we are equal. So what makes us equal can't be how we look. It can't be our height or weight or anything like that. It's got to be something else. What is that thing that even secular people will say makes everybody in this room equal? We are all endowed with what kind of rights? I'm sorry, inalienable rights, but those inalienable rights, they only apply to what kind of creatures? Humans. Call them human rights. Human rights. So what makes all of us equal is that all of us are human. By the nature, by belonging to a class of human beings, that's what gets us human rights. Chief amongst those rights, those inalienable rights we talked about, is the right to life. That's the chief. Now, not all life is equal, right? Human lives matter more. I can prove this to you. Christopher Kayser, in his book, has an intriguing example. He says, okay, so I'll doctor it up a little bit. You guys were a little bit late coming to this apologetics class, so you might have been driving in a little unredeemed fashion, right? And suddenly you're driving along, and you're trying to get here, and suddenly you hear that. And you look in the rearview mirror, and sure enough, on the ground behind you, in your dust, is a bunny. It's okay. Now, what do you do? You stop the car, you pull it over, you go back, you check on the bunny. Oh my goodness, it's not breathing. So you sit there and you start making little compressions on his little bunny chest. You put your mouth on his little furry mouth and go, poof, 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 poof. No? No? Do you want to know what you do? This is what you do. You go, aw. Right? Okay, change the scenario a bit. You're late for the apologetics class. You're driving a little fast, not paying a lot of attention. Boom, boom. You look in the rearview mirror, it's a 7-year-old boy. Now you can bet you're going to pull your car over. You can bet you're going to sit there and you are going to make compressions. You are going to breathe into that kid's mouth, and you will not stop until emergency medical people arrive on the scene and relieve you. And even then, you are not going to leave until police officers come and take your statement. Because if you do, you're going to jail. Human life and bunny life, very different. If something's rattling around in your dumpster, You can't just pull out a shotgun and start shooting it. In California, you can't even pull out a shotgun. But yeah, you until you find out what. What is it? What's in there? If it's rattlesnakes, boom, right? If it's the neighbor kid, no. So the most important thing is to find out what it is. We've already established the humanity of every human being from the moment of conception. All of us are human. So we should be done. But abortion advocates now, they want to have another look at premise one. Is it really wrong to intentionally kill all humans? So we engage now in the first big shift. Now you're going to find as we move through this section that our opponents do what I call arguing in retreat. Trying to nail them to the wall is like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. They're constantly shifting around trying to make changes. So we got to walk them through it, help them to understand. Is it human? Yeah, we all know it's human. By the way, little side note here. Every single time I have ever moderated or been in a debate on the abortion issue, I have never had my opponent, at least in the last 25 years, ever say from the platform that what's in a woman's body is not a human being. You want to know why? Because they know I will bury them in evidence. So they don't say it. So now what they do is they shift to these kinds of arguments that we're going to go through now. Why, by the way, do our opponents make this shift from human beings to persons? There's only one reason. The sole purpose of doing this is to create a class of human beings that it's morally permissible to kill. It's the only reason that they do it. If only some human beings are persons, then other human beings are these dehumanized non-persons. And I'm going to tell you, whenever you're trying to make life and death decisions by determining who does and does not belong in a particular group, that it's got to be a bright line distinction. You shouldn't have to wonder who's in which group. And I'm going to tell you right now, there's only one bright line available. Conception. See, before conception, that sperm is it's the guy's sperm. Before conception, that egg is the woman's egg. It's their cells, and whatever happens to them, it's not a big deal. You got plenty more of those, where those came from. Once those come together and form a brand new human being, now everything's different. So that's the bright line. Everything else is just development. Our opponents go, no. No, we got to make sure that you are a person. Now, what kind of standards do they use to justify this shift? Stephen Schwartz, in a book called The Moral Question of Abortion, lays out four standard categories that are used. My friend Scott Klusendorf has popularized this with his sled cards, and some of you may have seen those cards. But he did not originate this. He's just popularized it. The four standards, and by the way, when you talk to anybody about personhood, I don't care what the arguments are, they're going to fall into one of these four categories. Size, level of development, environment, and degree of dependency. SLED, sled. Number one, size. You know, it doesn't even look like a person. It's so small. As a matter of fact, Katha Pollitt in her book Pro says, who can call that a person? It's not even any bigger than the period at the end of the sentence. So they make the argument that if you're too small, you don't look like a person, then you're not a person. Number two, level of development. Doesn't act like a person. Early on, it's not sentient, doesn't have what we recognize as thoughts, can't communicate, can't express a will or any desires. It can't walk, talk, smile, doesn't form relationships, right? Doesn't have memories. All the things we associate, right, with well-developed persons. Number three, they make the argument about environment. Well, after all, how can it be a separate person when it's actually inside the body of this other person? It's not separate. As a matter of fact, some people say it's part of the woman's body. So how can it be a separate person, they say. And then number four is degree of dependency. And this is where we get into the viability argument. People say, well, it can't live on its own outside of the woman's body. And because it's not viable, can't be a person. Let's evaluate these standards and see if these are good standards to evaluate personhood. Too small? I've got news for you. On the day of your creation, when that sperm and that egg came together, you were a human being. Like I said, anybody with a powerful enough microscope would be able to tell if there's a separate DNA form there that's not the mom's, that's not the dad's, it's a separate human being. You do look like a human being. It's what every human being looks like on the first day of their existence. The issue, folks, is not the size or the appearance. The issue is with the untutored eyes of the people looking at you. They don't want to see a person there, and so they don't. And by the way, bigger is not more valuable. I wrote a Bible study once with A.C. Green. Any Laker fans in here?
Yeah.
Laker fans? Okay. You ever been around A.C.? He's huge, that dude. So we were working on a Bible study for a movie called Glory Road, and I met him on the lot, and we sat down and watched the movie together, and I met him and his wife. I don't know how big A.C. Green is. He's just mammoth. When you shake his hand, his hand takes your hand and your forearm and your elbow. I mean, he's just huge. His wife's like 5 feet tall, right? It's amazing. But while A.C. Green is more valuable than me on a basketball court, he's not more valuable than I am in terms of my humanity and in terms of my personhood and my right to be alive. Size is not the determining factor. What about level of development? Do I have any young people here tonight that are under the age of 25? If so, raise your hand. Under 25, under 25, under 25. Young man back there. How old are you, sir? You're 22. Okay. Your parents here tonight by any chance? No? Okay. It's a bummer because I wanted to point out that his dad is more developed than he is, which always makes the dad feel really good. You're not as developed as your dad is. Yeah, bad news for you. The two hemispheres of your brain have not fully zipped together, which is why guys under the age of 25, this is still a Baptist church, right? They have a hold my root beer moment, right? You guys familiar with that? Yeah. They do things, the emotional things, because the two hemispheres of your brain don't zip together until you're 25. Which, by the way, you might notice, have you rented a car recently? It's really expensive when you're 22. It becomes immediately less expensive when you're 25. There is a reason for that. Okay? How old are you, little one? You're 10. Do you have a sister? How old's your sister? Oh, gosh, you're the big sister. Okay. Have any teenage ladies in here? Yep. Okay. How old are you, young lady? You're 14? I need them older. Young ladies, 18 to 28. Hands up. I have no 18 to 28-year-old women, or are you just afraid to raise up your hand because they think I'm going to point you out? Okay. So this young girl over here, she is not less valuable than an 18-year-old girl just because the 18-year-old girl has, you know, young lady has got a fully developed reproductive system and she doesn't yet. She's not fully developed. But that doesn't make her unvaluable as a human being, right? She has the exact same value. As a matter of fact, I would argue that the weaker and less developed people are, the more claim they have to protection. And by the way, in many regards, the law would agree with me, except if you're in the womb. All of us have differing levels of skill. All of us have differing levels of accomplishment. The idea that we should come up with somebody, and by the way, when you ask people, how big do you have to be? Well, you're just a clump of cells. I got news for you. All of you are just a clump of cells. Amen. Right? Just varying degrees of organization, but you're all just, how many cells is enough? I don't know. How developed do you have to be to count as one of us? They don't ever want to tell you. They're just sure that if you're in the womb, in other words, they just assert that because you're in the womb, you don't qualify. What about environment? Okay, so Pastor Paul's over here, I'm over here. When I walk over toward Pastor Paul, I am walking orders of magnitude farther than any one of you traveled to get to the outside from the inside of your mother's womb. It's about 7 inches, or give or take. By the way, my two boys, they never even made it that far. Right out the abdomen. Right? Much shorter distance. And amazingly, even though they missed the magical transformation properties that occur when people travel down a birth canal, they still are pretty decent human beings. Nothing magical happens when we go from inside to outside. As a matter of fact, some of you have seen the photographs, right? They've got those photographs of intrauterine surgeries. You guys ever seen this one? Where they're doing surgery, they open the woman up, they reach into the abdomen, the little kid's hand pops out and grabs hold of the surgeon's finger. It was an award-winning photograph. Did you see that? So by the way our opponents argue, Right? Before the surgery, not a person. Hand pops out. Oh, person. He shoves them back in. Oh, not a person. Right? In other words, these kinds of standards, they don't make sense. And what about degree of dependency? You know what, folks? Many people are dependent. I got news for you. Any one of you in this room, you are one slip on some black ice away from being a 10-year-old for the rest of your life. It could happen to you. Don't wish it on anybody, but it could. Some people are born autistic. I've got a nephew who's pretty far along on that spectrum. Some people are born with Down syndrome. There are nations in Europe that claim to have gotten rid of Down syndrome. They haven't. They've just gotten rid of Down syndrome people. Some of us will grow up and we'll get Alzheimer's. My mother-in-law died of Alzheimer's. She lived with us the last 2 years of her life. She could not shelter herself. She could not toilet herself. She could not get a drink. She could not get any food. Every single thing that she needed done needed to be done for her. All of it. What I found fascinating when I thought more about that is that that's exactly everything that you do for a child in the womb. Right? Nutrition, hydration, waste removal services, safe place to live. That's what we provide unborn children. Well, it never occurred to me at any point in time to have thought of my mother-in-law as anybody other than Jenny Sosby. That person, that human being. And then finally, Stephen Schwartz, the same guy who did the sled, he said, I want you to imagine that a guy comes in, a criminal comes into a neonatal ICU unit, right, the NICU, and there are all of these incubators for preemie kids. And this is particularly important to me because I was a preemie. Now imagine the guy comes in there and begins strangling each one of the kids, one after another. What would happen to that guy? What? You go to jail, right? So why is it immoral and illegal to kill children in a mechanical incubator, but we actually pay people to kill children in the incubator of a mother's womb? Indeed, you might have a kid of the exact same gestational age in the incubator and in the womb, and as long as they're physically inside the womb, they're fair game. In many states, California, for example. And by the way, don't for a minute believe the argument that people float out there that the only reason anybody ever gets a late-term abortion is because there's these horrible fetal abnormalities. Not remotely true. There's been plenty of evidence out there that indicates that guys like that notorious abortionist in New Mexico, they aborted children in the very late second, very early third trimester, but were completely and utterly normal kids. And you know what? Even if they weren't, so what? They're human beings created in the image of God. And these standards are terrible standards. So why are these standards so bad? These standards are so bad because they don't just apply to the unborn. We're all of different sizes, right? We're all different heights and weights. We are all of different levels of development at varying times in our post-born lives. We all exist in different environments, and we all, to varying degrees, have degrees of dependency. By the way, we all start out very dependent, right? Then God willing, we grow up to be rational and independent, and then in a later portion of our life, hopefully we remain rational, but you are still going to become, if you live long enough, you're going to become dependent again. So if these are the standards for humanity, they don't just affect the unborn. And you're going to find out by the time I'm done tonight, this ideology, this pernicious, evil, demonic ideology literally puts every single one of you at risk. And I will prove it before the evening is out. There is no morally significant distinction between the embryo you used to be and the person you are right now that would have justified killing you then, but not now. This is a line my friend Scott Klusendorf says all the time. The problem is our opponents have literally flipped it on its head. See, they argue, well, yeah, and since we could kill you back then, I guess we can kill you now. And that's what you're going to see is coming. Once we demonstrate that the standards for assigning personhood are horribly, fatally flawed, and we should not adopt them because they put all postborn people at risk, then people, it's really funny what happens, then our opponents, it's almost like they start acting like that syllogism doesn't even exist anymore. We don't even want to talk about that because, after all, what they're going to do now is they're going to appeal to your pity. I don't have time to get all deeply into this, but if you have ever read The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis, He talks about how pity can be used as a bludgeon to get otherwise good people to do evil things to relieve temporary sufferings of other people. He says many a young woman who had a boyfriend going off to war lost her virtue that way. Oh, you know, who knows if I'll ever come back. Right? Appeals to pity. So now we're going to shift from personhood to exceptions due to the origin of conception. This is what people refer to as hard cases. And I got to tell you, of all the things I talk about, this is the one that's toughest for most people to hear. But bear with me. The standards that they use are rape and incest. And they say, listen, if a woman gets violently raped by a man and then she finds herself pregnant, why in the world should she have to carry that rapist's child? And then if she gives birth to that child, won't that child be a constant reminder of the way in which she was assaulted? Right? Does this sound familiar? By the way, if you can think of anything else, let me know. And I got to let you know, very, very sympathetic to this. So how do you respond to this? The most important thing to remember is the first words out of your mouth are not going to be an argument. You have no idea why somebody is bringing this up. Maybe they themselves, they've been a victim of rape or incest. So the first thing that needs to come out of your mouth is sympathy. I need to let you know if you have been, now I'm going to talk about this as a public speaker. I got public people, somebody stands up, well, what about rape and incest? I'm going to tell people, I got to let you know, I think that rape is a horrible, terrible crime. It violates the bodily integrity of the people who are its victims. And I said people because I got news for you. If you read my book, you will read instances of men who have been raped by women. And don't think it can happen. I've got evidence that demonstrates that it does. But it's a horrible thing if it happens. And if a person is caught, if they are tried, if they are convicted by a jury of their peers, they should be punished to the fullest extent of the law. Now, it's really funny when I talk about these scenarios and I say, you know, what should happen to violent rapists? People, so funny. In California, they go, therapy? And out here, people go, kill them. Right? So, depending on where you are, you know, very different response. But I got news for you. Since the late 1970s, the Supreme Court has said that you cannot put even a violent, serial rapist, you can't put them to death. It's considered to be cruel and unusual punishment. It cannot happen. So, I want to tell people, though, I want to punish rapists to the fullest extent of the law. By the way, when I'm in a public setting like this, and frequently you're in a debate setting, and people will get up and they'll start talking about rape and incest, they don't really care about rape and incest. What they really care about is painting you out to be a moral monster because you don't care about women. So there's an easy way to expose this, and that's to say, hey, you know what, just for the sake of argument, not going to say I'm going to do this, but just for the sake of argument, you know, track with me here. What if I was willing to craft a law that would outlaw all abortion in the state of California, but we would make a carve-out for women who are victims of rape or incest as long as they reported it within the first 15 weeks. Would you be willing to jump on board with me and stump for that law in the state of California? That's right. Bingo. 99.9999999999% of the time, they'll go, well, no. At which point in time, we got to stop being on the defensive and start becoming offensive. Right? Which is, how dare you? How dare you use the pain and suffering of rape and incest victims in order to score cheap political points and advance a completely unrelated agenda? And by the way, in case you're wondering if that happens, we'll get to this later on, but this is precisely what Robin Marty in her book, Handbook for a Post-Roe America, says that they're going to do. They're going to literally use rape and incest as the nose of the camel under the tent, and she makes it clear in the book. You can read the quotation for yourself. She says, this will be the strategy we will use to completely overturn all restrictions on abortion. Not just rape and incest. It's a tactic to them. For us, it's not a tactic. It's a terrible, horrible thing when people are victims of rape and incest. So, what we need to do, though, is explain that the circumstances of someone's conception doesn't change the nature of who they are. So, what I tell people to do is let's count people. So, here, scenario. A man violently rapes a woman, and as a result of that rape, a child is conceived. Okay, how many human beings are we talking about now in this scenario?
Three.
Okay, now what we're going to do is we're going to assign guilt and innocence. The man, guilty or innocent?
Guilty.
Okay, the woman, guilty or innocent? What are you talking about? Of course he's innocent. Now, what about the child they've conceived?
Innocent.
Ooh, innocent. All right, now we're going to determine what we should do to these people. So, the serial violent rapist, we should... See? This is how you know you don't have a lot of Catholics in here, because they'd be going... Okay, but you can't. The court will not put this guy to death. So, punish him to the fullest extent of the law. What should we do to that woman? Ooh, do to that woman, not to for that woman, right? What should we do for the woman? Help her, take care of her. Right, you provide her with all of the things that she needs to be able... By the way, nobody ever gets over this, but you can get through it. Okay? So she's going to need the physical, emotional, and spiritual resources necessary to be able to bring her pregnancy to term. Now, she can choose if she likes, after the baby is born, she can choose to place that child for adoption. She can, by the way, she can do it in an open adoption. She can do it in a closed adoption. All the power resides with the birth mother. Right? She gets to do that. But what about the baby? What should we do to the baby? Remember, the baby's one of the innocent people in this scenario. Ooh, protect the baby. And frankly, why shouldn't we do the same thing to the innocent baby that we would do for the innocent woman? Provide all of the physical, emotional, and spiritual support this child needs so the mom can make a life-affirming decision. The baby is fine. Here's something that almost nobody on the abortion side of this issue will ever tell you. Do you know that the majority of women who conceive as a result of an act of rape choose to have their baby? And do you know that the majority of those women who choose to have their baby choose to parent that baby themselves? People have got this weird idea that every single woman who gets raped, she rushes off to an abortion clinic. That every single woman who gets raped, she gives her child away as quickly as she possibly can. It's just not true. It's not true. It's the narrative that our opponents tell to paint you as a monster for not letting her put her child to death. But my question is why in the world in this scenario, why is the only person at risk from capital punishment one of the innocent ones? And it's funny, you say that even on a college classroom, if you explain it that way, a lot of times people think about it for a minute and go, never thought. I've actually had people tell me I've never thought about it that way. Because I usually end that with saying, does that sound fair to you? Kind of hard to come up with a fairness argument given those particulars. Punish rapists to the fullest extent of the law, though. And I'll tell you, after watching Sound of Freedom, I think maybe that Supreme Court case needs to be revisited. Because people who do that kind of stuff to kids don't think that they need to be around. Then I want to walk you through a couple of thought experiments. I got three or four of them in my book, but I'm going to just have time to go through a couple of them here. First one is, let's say a woman is really wanting to get pregnant, but she doesn't want the messiness of a relationship or a husband. But she's got some really particular ideas about what she wants the father of her child to look like. He'd be tall, good-looking, intellectual, powerful, business guy, you know, all this stuff. And so she can't find a guy like that who's willing to impregnate her, so she goes to a bar with a friend of hers. She meets this guy who thinks this guy's a perfect candidate, so she kind of cozies up to him at the bar and talks to him for a little while, and then eventually, she tries to put some moves on him, and the guy says, oh, hey, honey, look, I'm just here on business, and, I'm married. And so she goes, oh, okay. And when he turns away, she roofies him. She and her accomplice haul him off into a hotel room where they tie him to the bed, strip him naked, and then the guy wakes up. She decides that she is going to have relations with him, and she successfully does so. And by the way, those of you who are saying, that can't ever happen, you are unfamiliar with biology, because it can and does. Now, fortunately for the guy, she lets him live. She just leaves. And then eventually his cries for help are heard by staff that come in and untie him, and he gives the full description he can, and fortunately for him, there are security cameras outside this hotel. They manage to catch the license plate of the car. And so it takes a little while, but they finally track the woman down and find her 3 months later, and sure enough, she's pregnant. They do a paternity test. Sure enough, it's his kid. So when I'm on a college campus, I look at my students and I say, does this man have the right to force her to abort that child? You ever want to watch people's heads explode? Right? Because on the one hand, they're going, well, it is a rape. And on the other hand, they're going, but that's a woman, and you're not supposed to force a woman to do anything. And so the tension becomes really, really great. And most people will tell you, no, you can't force her to abort that child. But why not? The sex was not consensual. Yeah, this is different. Okay. A man and a woman are living together, and she's got a girlfriend. girlfriend kind of likes this guy. She doesn't have a boyfriend, but she's starting to get baby fever, and she wants to have a baby. So one evening, after having relations with her boyfriend, she grabs the condom, goes into the bathroom, and artificially inseminates her girlfriend. And then, 3 months later, she and her boyfriend get in this big fight, and she says, "Oh, yeah?" And then she spills what she did. The guy is obviously, you know, upset. They track down the girl, find out she's 3 months pregnant. Does he have the right to force her to have an abortion? Okay, it wasn't forced, but it wasn't consensual. He didn't want that, didn't want to have a baby. You ask people these questions, and almost always they'll go, no. So see, it's not about force. It's not about consent. It's not about having offspring running around that look like you. That's not what it's about. What it's about is the belief that every woman has some kind of inherent right to dispose of her own offspring. And you're going to find out later on this evening, anytime she wants to. So once the humanity of the unborn is established, then we can't punish one innocent human being for the crimes of another human being. Right? The law shouldn't work that way. So let me wrap up where we are, and then I'm going to move on to this next section. We're going to take a quick break. It's wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. We've proven that what's in a woman's body is, in fact, a human being, and abortion intentionally kills it. Therefore, abortion's wrong. Then our opponents get up and say, okay, yeah, but it's not really a person. So they say, let's change the syllogism. It's wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human person. Well, we've demonstrated that abortion does kill an innocent human person because all human beings are persons. And all the standards used to try to divide humans from persons all fail the test. Right? So if you make a big Venn diagram, you know, Kamala Harris, she likes her Venn diagrams. You make a big Venn diagram of all human beings, and then you make another circle of all persons, and all the circle of human beings all fits within the person's circle. By the way, some of you are looking at me like, well, aren't they the same circle? Well, of course not. I can think of all kinds of beings that are persons, but not humans. Come on, Pastor, help me out. Name a being who's a person, but not human. Very good. Angels. Right? There are other beings that are persons that aren't humans. But all humans are persons. And then they just toss the whole thing out and go, okay, I don't even want to look at that syllogism anymore because I'm losing with it. So, but what about rape and incest? So they try to appeal to your pity. Let them know you feel pity. You want to help. Anybody who's in difficult circumstances, they need help. But what they don't need help doing is something immoral. Because no abortion ever unraped a woman. All it ever does is do something worse to her child than was done to her. So we have to help people get moral clarity. And remember, folks, there's not always a good middle ground. If you are living in the time of Nazi Germany, and you and your mother get hauled out of a train, and the Nazi guys say to you, I got two choices here. I'm going to shoot you dead, or you can save yourself by torturing your mother to death. So what they're saying is you got two choices. You can either engage in evil or be a victim of evil. There's no third way. And when we talk about rape and incest, there's no third way. We're either going to participate in an evil to extend that evil, or we're going to choose to do something heroic. There's no middle heroic ground. Then we move into this third big shift, and I'm only going to have time right now before our break to just go through what the arguments are. And when we come back from the break, I will answer them. The third shift shifts from the means of conception to exceptions due to the impact of pregnancy. So now we're not even talking about rape and incest anymore. We're all talking about me. What happens to me? And I don't like what's happening to me if I'm pregnant, and so I don't think that you should tell me that I can't have an abortion. Here are the standards that are used. Common exception arguments. The threat to the mother's life. An example for this would be if a woman had an ectopic pregnancy. Now, there are memes running around saying, oh, these pro-life people, they're not even going to let you treat a woman who has an ectopic pregnancy. And so there are some things that happen during a pregnancy that actually literally put a woman's life at risk. And they're saying, well, we have to have abortion for that. Number two, my body, my choice. There are two forms of this. The first form is what I call the simple bumper sticker form. A lot of our opponents, they love to argue in bumper stickers. They don't ever have to actually, work out the implications of their argument. They just say them, my body, my choice, my body, my choice. And they walk around with signs and say that. That's the simple version where they say, you know, a fetus is part of a woman's body, therefore I can do whatever I want. But there is a more sophisticated version, which is revealed in a journal article by a woman named Judith Jarvis Thompson. It's about the analogy she uses is called the violinist analogy. So let me give it to you real quick. There's a guy, he's a world famous violinist, but he's got this blood disorder and it's really, really bad and he's going to die. And so a bunch of his fans, really rabid music lovers, they find out you are just the person. And if they could hook you up to them, you could cleanse his blood and stabilize him. So while you're walking out on the street, they throw a black hood over your head, kidnap you, and you wake up in the bowels of a hospital. Hooked up to the violinist. The hospital administrator comes down and he says, "Hey, dude, sorry, really sorry. We didn't do this to you. It was those incredible terrorist music lovers, right, who did it." Paul, you're sitting in the wrong place, man. I keep pointing at you. That's who did it. But I got good news for you. If you will just lay here on this table for the next 9 months hooked up to the violinist, then at the end of that time, we can safely disconnect you and you can go along your merry way. Now, at any point in time, of course, if you really feel like you have to, we can unhook you. And you can go, but I got to let you know that the violinist is going to die. Now, Judith Jarvis Thompson asks, are you morally obligated to stay hooked up to the violinist for the next 9 months? And, of course, what she's hoping that you're going to come to the conclusion of is that, no, you're not. And I got news to you. News for you. No, you're not morally obligated to stay hooked up to somebody. You got kidnapped. You got hooked up. And that's what she wants you to think. Next, we have a threat to the mother's physical health. So there are things that happen during a pregnancy that put women's health, not necessarily their life, but their health at risk. These are things like placenta previa, placenta acida. These are examples where the placenta grows either over the cervix or too deeply into the uterine wall, and it can put a woman's health at risk. Some women, maybe some of you have had gestational diabetes. Maybe you've had hypertension that comes as a result of pregnancy. These are all threats to a woman's life, and they say since women's lives are being threatened or their health is being threatened, and by the way, you see all the way the abortion laws are written, life or health. This is an example, one of the examples of health. But there are others. The psychological well-being of the mother. You know, some women, when they get pregnant, they become very sad. They don't want to be pregnant. Some of them get very depressed. Some of them, I'll be straight with you, some of them get suicidal because they're pregnant. They think their parents are going to kill them when they find out. And so they say in order to restore psychological balance, women need to be able to have an abortion. The threat to the economic well-being of the mother. She's got a job promotion coming up that requires 90% travel, and she can't do that if she's out there with a baby, she thinks. Or she just got a scholarship to OU, and she runs hurdles, which is hard to do, you know, at 8 months pregnant if that's when track season is. And so it's going to hurt her opportunity if she continues this pregnancy. And in order for her to have equity with men, she believes that she needs to have abortions available to her. The social stigma that attaches to unwed motherhood. People are going to tease her or berate her because she had sex outside of marriage. And now here's the example of it. The age of the mother. She's too young. We can't have babies having babies. You'll hear that's another bumper sticker argument. Or she's too old. Because, you know, if you're too old, maybe you'll be at risk of neural tube defects like spina bifida or Down syndrome. Fetal abnormality, right? If you do amniocentesis and you got fetal abnormality and the stress associated with that, well, nobody should have to go through that. And if we can just take care of it early enough, that's why doctors, when they find that out, they say, what would you like to do? And what they're really asking is, do you really want this one? Because if you don't, we can get rid of this one. The unborn is an undesired gender. And I don't mean like a Gucci bag. That's the wrong, you know, flavor. But there are cultures in which we value male children over female children. We do an ultrasound. We find out the child is female. And they say, well, you know, we want to have male children. And so they get rid of that child. They want the right to be able to do that. The unborn child is unwanted. That's been Planned Parenthood's shtick from forever, right? Every child a wanted child, right? That's what they say. And so they say if a child's unwanted, they're going to grow up unloved. They're going to probably have criminal tendencies. There could be all kinds of problems. Therefore, that's why we need to have abortion. And then finally, this is one of my favorites, and then we're going to take a break, and that is the planet is simply overpopulated. So you just can't keep, if any responsible person who wants to minimize their carbon footprint is going to reduce the number of children. In fact, it'd be better if you just didn't have any. Now, I'm not telling you to do something crazy like not have sex. Have all the sex you want. Just make sure that if you conceive a child, you got abortion available to you because that's the responsible thing to do. So these are the arguments that people give for the impact of pregnancy on others for as a rationale for why we need to have abortion. So when we come back, I'm going to give you, I'm a mean college professor, I'm going to give you 7 minutes. I'll give you 8. Never say I didn't do something for you. Give me 8 minutes. I want us to come back by the time that clock hits 20 till, because it's going to take a while to get through the rest of this. When I come back, I will kick off by answering all of these, and then I will field a few questions, not a bunch, but just a few, and then I'll field all the ones you want at the end, but I want to make sure that I honor your time. Okay, jump up, grab a cookie, get some coffee. You're going to need it. Hit a restroom.